Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to the show. On a personal note, many of you may know that I am the father of IVF twins. I was infertile from cancer treatment, and I've been a very vocal fatherly spokesperson for fertility rights and family planning for over 20 years. And I've worked with a wonderful nonprofit called Resolve, who does great work, really great work. You can check them out at resolve.org. And I approached them a couple of years ago after the Cancer Mavericks did so very well as a documentary. Can we do something smaller that just amplifies the narrative on family planning through cancer or any other disease that just is a barrier to, you know, becoming a mom or a dad? So we came up with this pilot program called Not Expecting, which turned into a wonderful, basically a one episode, pilot episode about the narrative. And it's airing now wherever you get your podcast. Just look for Not Expecting. But I wanted to play it here on my show just because, in case you missed it, you'll hear it now. So without further ado, and a very brief introduction right now, I present to you the pilot episode of Not Expecting. Enjoy.
In the early 80s, Judy and Roger Carr allowed a documentary crew to tape their experience having the first baby conceived by in vitro fertilization in the United States. Judy and Roger sat for interviews and let the cameras roll, capturing modern medical technology in action.
Judy is 28 years old. She's been married 9 years. Nine childless years.
It was just 10 years after Roe v. Wade had made abortion legal. The birth control pill had been approved years before. It was the middle of the women's liberation movement. And yet, 9 childless years. Really? It's like saying every year a woman is married and doesn't have a child, she is without value. The Nova documentary is called A Daughter for Judy. What about Roger? Roger has had 9 childless years too, but no one mentioned that. Judy and Roger were living in Massachusetts. Roger was an engineer. Judy was a teacher, finishing up school.
Did they want a family at once?
No, I had to finish my education first, and I had about 2 more years to go. So that's what we did, and as soon as that was over with, that's when we started.
But things did not go well. Judy had several miscarriages, and one time she miscarried so badly, she almost died.
I went to the bed to try and get her up, and she was just as white as a sheet. I mean, just completely no color at all. So I immediately called the doctor, said, we're going to bring her into the hospital. Now, how bad it was, we didn't find out until afterwards. If it had been like 10 more minutes, she would have had lost so much blood that she probably wouldn't have made it.
When the doctor came in, Judy said, he was rather blunt.
And he said, well, I have good news and bad news. And Roger was sitting there with me. And the good news is you're alive. And I'm, I know this, you know, I'm aware of this fact. And the second thing is, he said, the bad news is you'll probably never have children.
Welcome to the series Not Expecting, The Fight for Fertility. Wait, no, scratch that. That's not right. How about not expecting the long and painstaking journey for fertility? That more captures the art. Art as in assisted reproductive technology, and art as in the art of trying. And trying again. You try again. It starts to feel like a test on your soul. So you rise and try again. But it's not just a personal journey. It's also the long and painstaking political path that fertility advocates have been on for decades, all of which is now suddenly in the spotlight because of the Supreme Court decision that struck down Roe v. Wade. So let's land on not expecting the personal and political story of fertility rights in the U.S. This is episode 1, the IVF quest. Let's dive into what it takes to get access to treatments deemed medically necessary. Back to Judy and Roger. Judy and Roger had tried a few times, but each pregnancy ended in a miscarriage. Then their doctors proposed a solution. At that time, it was a relatively new method of impregnating a woman, in vitro fertilization. The sperm fertilizes the egg in a petri dish. The fertilized embryo is tested to see if it's viable, and if so, doctors transfer it to the woman's uterus. Doctors in England and Australia had shown it could be done. The first IVF baby was born in 1978 in England. She was healthy. Parents were happy. So Judy let the cameras capture the whole thing, the egg retrieval, the embryo implantation, and the birth.
Ultrasound was right. It's a girl.
It's a girl.
While that was met with a great deal of fanfare, I think that if you follow how people were looking at it, it was viewed as a little bit of weird science, a little bit of what's happening in that Frankenstein laboratory.
Barb Kalura is the president and CEO of Resolve, the National Infertility Association. Like so many others, she was watching this medical frontier take shape, imagining how it could affect lives.
You had a lot of interest from people who were having trouble getting pregnant, but you still had a great deal of skepticism and thinking, is this really needed? Is this really necessary?
So you've got a woman, a perfectly fine woman who was finishing her education, but because she was married and had no offspring, she was a childless woman. She goes to have a baby and almost dies. They offer her a medical treatment. But is it really necessary? All that fuss?
Do you remember when people used to say things like, she has cancer? And they would whisper the C word. She has cancer. You know, that's how infertility was.
Risa Levine is a longtime volunteer for Resolve, and she was a lawyer in New York City. She says she knew infertility was common. The current numbers are 1 in 5 American women, but
it was something to be ashamed of. It was private. It was embarrassing. It was shameful. It was a weakness.
Roger and Judy Carr had opened up to the world about their struggles. They were outspoken about their journey and the medical process they chose. At a time when the stigma of infertility was silencing, Judy went public. She pushed back on the term test tube baby. Doesn't even make sense, she said. There are 0 test tubes involved. Roger challenged the idea that they were playing God.
I just can't possibly understand how anyone could think that what was done in England. I don't see how anybody could say that this is immoral or that people are playing God. I mean, to me, if they take our little baby when it's born and they hold it in its hands, how anybody can say that that is wrong, I can't understand. I don't know how, you know, I could explain to them that there's nothing wrong. Here is a human life, a newborn baby. Now tell me what is immoral about that.
After the news broke about the Carrs' baby, more couples signed up for IVF. But there were so many questions. What are the chances an IVF treatment works? How much would it cost? How many people needed fertility treatments, and why? Were there medical professionals being trained in this new scientific landscape? And what about the patients? What kind of toll would this take?
I actually told him on the highway, leaving a doctor's appointment. I looked him dead in the eye. I meant it. It was straight from the heart. I wanted him to go have a baby with another woman. A woman who was capable, who was able.
There's a real cost to fertility treatments. Money-wise, yes. But there's a cost to your body, your marriage, your friendships, your sanity, yourself. How much is it worth to you? After the break. It was 2004, and Risa Levine and her then-husband were living in New York City trying to have a baby. But they were having difficulty getting pregnant and staying pregnant. Infertility treatments were going to be very expensive.
His company did not have any coverage at all, and I had a $10,000 lifetime max. And that was all we had.
In New York City, that could maybe cover the cost of ICE in a hospital. So that wasn't going to work. Nowadays, a typical IVF treatment, that's one cycle with medications, costs anywhere from $18,000 to $30,000.
I immediately started searching to see what could be done on a legislative level to see if we, because it wasn't just me, it was a lot of people who had the same problem.
She was a lawyer, and she'd done some student lobbying on Capitol Hill when she was in college. So she started looking for ways to get this topic in front of state lawmakers.
I was part of an IVF support group and one of those online message boards, and I solicited stories from people that I only knew by their screen names, and they emailed me and sent me their stories, and I printed those up, and I downloaded a bunch of CDC statistics, and I printed off the costs at various clinics, and I put together information packets on my own, and I started to hand them out to anybody that I can get in front of.
She was energized and passionate, but not to everyone.
It was the weirdest thing for me because I was telling legislators, I was telling people very high up in government, but my closest friends, the women who had been my bridesmaids, didn't know that I was going through treatment.
Eventually, a New York congressman told her about a group called Resolve, a grassroots advocacy group that was working on fertility rights. In the 1970s, a woman in Massachusetts, a nurse named Barbara Eck, had started organizing around a topic that was close to her heart. She was experiencing her own infertility.
And she formed the first support group around her kitchen table and started a newsletter and started reaching out very grassroots.
Rebecca Flick is the chief external affairs officer for Resolve.
Newsletter expanded, I guess this is a printed newsletter back in the day. We had chapters across the country.
The whole Resolve team, now with Risa, worked on getting infertility into mainstream dialogue. They wanted everyone to know infertility is not a dirty word. They were growing in numbers, and their voices were getting louder. By 2004, the organization's headquarters moved from Massachusetts to Washington, D.C. And once they were situated, they started pushing federal lawmakers to acknowledge that there was very little healthcare coverage for the hundreds of thousands of people who were in the same boat. Advocates from all over the U.S. came to the Capitol. One year, they had someone from every single state come to share their very personal, very painful story.
So our advocate, if I can paint a picture, is largely a woman in her 30s. And they're facing the staffer who is usually in their 20s and has very little knowledge of what someone's going to go through. And they take a deep breath. They talk about the most intimate part of their life. But that's what you're there for. You're there to educate them and put a face on it. And so I'm so sorry. This is so not me, for the first time in their entire fertility journey, they feel control.
It was emotional labor before we had a term for it. The health insurance for what was, and really still is, thought of as a woman's issue was scarce. Rebecca remembers the problems she and her husband faced.
The insurance that we had access to at the time was through the Department of Defense and my husband's job, and it was horrific.
Most federally funded health insurance did not, and still does not, cover IUI and IVF treatments. So if you have Medicaid, if you're in the military or you're a vet, a federal employee, you're not covered for IUI and IVF in most states. But what about Rebecca's health insurance from her employer?
One insurance plan would not kick in until I had suffered 3 miscarriages to prove that I could not get pregnant, which just sounds like torture. I couldn't even get pregnant to then miscarry.
To say everyone's infertility journey is unique is beyond an understatement, Barb says.
The problem with diagnosing and treating infertility is it, quite honestly, was personalized medicine back when personalized medicine didn't even exist.
Reproductive endocrinology is about as personalized medicine as you could possibly get, she says. For instance, if your insurance says you must do 3 cycles of intrauterine insemination, where sperm is placed in the uterus using a small catheter.
Well, hello. What if there's no sperm? IUI, you can't do IUI if there's no sperm. Of course, then you can do donor sperm. Is that covered? What about blocked fallopian tubes? The egg isn't going anywhere. The egg is stuck. The egg can't move. You can do 100,000 IUIs and the person is never going to get pregnant. So what is going on and what is the best course of treatment? So there are lots of people with blocked fallopian tubes who were forced to do 3 IUIs and that was covered. And every time they did it, the doctors were like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life.
Today, Barb says, we have about 15 states that require some insurance companies cover some kind of fertility treatment. Each state is able to put their own definition on fertility coverage. Barb and her team made a map of what states cover what. Some states require health insurers to cover IVF and fertility preservation for medically induced infertility. That's like when people freeze their eggs or sperm before they undergo chemo or radiation. But, she says, there are some states that offer the bare minimum.
There's some states that have an infertility insurance statute, but it may not actually cover anybody. And so that's a state like Texas or Montana or Ohio. And the way it's written, it just says that maybe insurers have to offer this kind of coverage, but it has no mandate to require coverage.
Some states that do require insurance companies cover fertility treatments say a person must show continuous years of trying to conceive naturally. In other words, through unprotected intercourse. Some even specify you have to use your husband's sperm. Rebecca Flick says that leaves out so many people.
You're leaving out men whose male birth factor infertility does not allow them to impregnate their spouse. You're leaving out single women who want to pursue parenthood on their own.
And you're leaving out lesbian couples.
Welcome back, everyone. Time now, 8:16. A lesbian couple in New Jersey say they were unfairly prevented from getting health insurance coverage for infertility treatments. Now, the married women are now suing over the very specific way New Jersey law defines infertility. Elaine Keanu.
In 2016, a lesbian couple sued the state of New Jersey. At the time, New Jersey was one of 15 states that required insurers to cover infertility diagnosis and treatment. The couple submitted a claim for infertility treatment to their insurance, but they were turned down even though they had had several miscarriages, and one of them had endometriosis and cysts, which gained a diagnosis of infertility from the doctors. And yet, they weren't covered because of an unprotected intercourse clause. They filed a federal lawsuit against the state agency that regulates insurance companies. The suit claimed discrimination. Remember, Obamacare passed in 2008, and it prohibited insurance companies from discriminating against patients based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. The couple won their lawsuit, and the law changed in New Jersey. I emailed one of the women for an interview. She wrote that she'd really considered it, but they'd participated in a long interview on the topic about a year ago. It was emotionally draining, she wrote. The battle for health insurance coverage isn't the only reason patients, doctors, and advocates need to work the halls of their state house. The very treatments they seek are under threat of being taken away altogether by the government.
When you define a fertilized egg or an embryo as a person, you significantly limit the ability to practice IVF.
After the break. Welcome back to Not Expecting, the personal and political story of fertility rights in the U.S. In 2009, the World Health Organization recognized infertility as a disease. The American Medical Association recognized it as a disease in 2017. You no longer had to have, say, endometriosis or fibroids on your uterus. Unexplained infertility was now accepted as a disease. And insurance companies cover diseases. It was a major win for fertility advocates like Resolve. But
gay and lesbian people, many, many of them, seeking out fertility medicine are not diagnosed with infertility.
Laura is a health practitioner and acupuncturist. We're not going to use her last name. She says there are LGBTQ folks who don't fit into the classification of having a disease.
I am a bisexual woman, and my husband now is a trans man.
Laura says she and her husband have a few characteristics that complicate their quest to get pregnant. And then,
I have an infertility diagnosis because I'm seeking fertility treatment. But I'm not sick. I'm 40. That's not pathology.
Together, she and her husband don't fit into a disease category. Rebecca Flick agrees this is a tricky area. And the disease qualification didn't work for all LGBTQ folks. And it excluded them from Resolve's advocacy work.
They didn't feel like they fit with Resolve. And to be completely transparent, we weren't talking about LGBTQ family building. We weren't, you know, representing, you know, and it wasn't conscious. It wasn't deliberate. But we were focused on people who had a disease. And we were able to talk about it as a disease to start talking about insurance coverage.
But it's about coding. So this goes into insurance and like how basically the insurance industry defines medicine and not the other way around.
Rebecca says Resolve is focused on filling the gaps in their advocacy. There are several state house bills that center on family building. One would bring fertility coverage to all public employees. That's in North Dakota. Another would bring equity to fertility coverage, requiring insurers to cover single and LGBTQ people who seek medical care. That's in New York. There's another state-by-state map on their website. This one shows the work they have ahead. You might say the topic, the label of infertility, has come a long way since the 1980s. There are blogs, YouTube channels, hashtags, and social media groups that show outspoken people who are hungry for parenthood. Some folks are willing to go to any means necessary. Some draw a line in the sand, hitting the brakes at a personal boundary. But all of it is hard. After a spell of doctor's appointments and blood draws, home injections and heartbreak, one woman told me she needed a beat to put her head back on. Ivory Lipscomb Warren and her husband Kevin live in Maryland. They started trying to get pregnant soon after they were married. But
I was diagnosed with infertility at the age of 25.
When Ivory first went to a fertility clinic, she got the feeling they were more interested in boosting their own analytics. How many women had successful treatments and in the least amount of cycles? I mean, everyone wants a successful pregnancy as soon as possible, But, she said, she felt like she was in some kind of factory. Ivory didn't go with that first fertility clinic she and her husband visited. She searched until she found a clinic that felt like a family. And she built a team of support. Doctors who valued her questions, an acupuncturist, a therapist.
The insurance actually paid 100% unlimited for fertility treatment. So that would include if I wanted to do in vitro fertilization or IVF or intrauterine insemination, which is IUI, we could do either or. Again, unlimited as well. And so that was covered at 100%.
So they started trying.
I underwent 9 cycles of in vitro fertilization.
But she had several miscarriages. It was alienating and painful, and it was traumatic. She says she lost lifelong friends who weren't compassionate to her grief. And she says she often felt like her body was falling apart. But it didn't cause a rift in her marriage. In fact, she says, she felt the partnership with her husband got stronger. Yet she often felt responsible for their fertility problems, like her body wasn't doing what it was supposed to do.
I actually told him on the highway, leaving a doctor's appointment, I looked him dead in the eye. I meant it. It was straight from the heart. I wanted him to go have a baby with another woman, a woman who was capable, who was able.
Fertility issues, miscarriages, the loss of personal relationships. Ivory says it's not often discussed in the Black community. She was raised, you keep your private life private. And when she looked around for support in the public sphere, she didn't see a lot of representation. There were no Black advocates.
It was very white. There are not a lot of coaches, therapists that look like me.
She has since become a fertility coach herself. But back then, she built a support team of medical professionals and started IVF.
Once they retrieved the eggs, they would put the eggs with the sperm, see if they would mature. And if they did, then we would send them for genetic testing. And those that did, they were normal, we would freeze them. And those that were abnormal, we would discard them.
And finally, they found success.
Eventually had my baby boy at the age of 43 and 19 years of marriage.
But it is precisely all that trying, all those discarded embryos from 9 infertility treatments that put IVF in the danger zone when it comes to politics. For years, some anti-abortion activists have fought to establish the right to personhood for fertilized eggs and embryos. In other words, give them all the legal rights that you or I have. It began in the 1970s, right after the Supreme Court ruled in Roe v. Wade that abortion was legal. Why did they want to establish personhood in fertilized eggs and embryos? Because if they could do that, they'd have a chance at overturning Roe. See, in 1973, when Roe was decided, the U.S. Supreme Court majority noted that the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. But, just as Harry Blackmun noted, if this suggestion of personhood is established, Roe's case, of course, collapses, for the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. The anti-abortion activists now had their marching order: get the personhood movement on the ground.
11 years ago, Facebook reminded me, 11 years ago, personhood was introduced in Virginia, in my home state.
Rebecca Flick says it was a bill like those popping up in state legislatures or on ballots around the country. It would give rights from the moment of fertilization.
They were using a fertilized egg and calling it a person. And when you define a fertilized egg or an embryo as a person, you significantly limit the ability to practice IVF.
Resolve rallied their troops and went to Richmond. They had fertility doctors and patients speak in front of legislators. And ultimately, personhood did not pass in Virginia. But Rebecca says that was not the end for the personhood movement.
After that, personhood really started to pick up all over the country.
The personhood bills, if passed, were supposed to lead the way to overturning Roe, making discarding embryos illegal. But then something happened that's revitalized the personhood movement.
The Supreme Court has overturned Roe versus Wade. Let me just repeat that, because this is a huge moment for the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States has overturned Roe versus Wade, the abortion rights ruling. A huge moment, a hugely divisive moment for the United States. We have been waiting for this to come through, and now we have the details that we have been waiting for.
In the Dobbs v. Jackson decision, the Supreme Court declined to weigh in on fetal personhood. Judge Samuel Alito wrote, "Our opinion is not based on any view about if and when prenatal life is entitled to any of the rights enjoyed after birth." The ruling simply said that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. It was up to each individual state. So with Roe gone, the question of personhood is once again open to debate. Rebecca Flick says it's a debate that isn't quieting down.
We are scared because, again, over the past decade or so, it's been more like a whack-a-mole. Like, they've popped up, we've swatted, they've gone away. Then maybe the next year, two or three pop up, we've swatted. This is a fire hose.
In the past 2 years, fetal personhood bills were introduced in 13 state houses. The personhood debate has also figured into the court battle for mifepristone, known as the abortion pill. The judge in the Texas case, who invalidated the FDA approval for the pill, described a fetus or an embryo as an unborn child. And now other politicians are coming forward saying they want to remove mifepristone from the market to protect the unborn. The Supreme Court is preserving access to the abortion pill for now. They're expected to once again weigh in on abortion rights by 2025. Advocates for family planning are bracing themselves for a battle, and it is exactly the kind that puts IVF in jeopardy. Not Expecting is a production of Offscript Health. I'm Mary Rose Madden, the senior producer and reporter. The executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Audio engineering and editing by Kyle Moore. Thank you for listening.